My name is Maylene Christopher. I am a manager of delegated credentialing with UnitedHealthcare and also the ICE co-lead for California. With me, I have Suki Ewers with Cigna. She is also a co-lead with me in California. And then Cindy Minnick, who is a delegation account manager with UnitedHealthcare. And she's one of our ICE co-leads for the Mid-Atlantic region. She is also in process of creating and building the ICE Texas expansion. So we're happy to be with her, with you all today. And Suki, you want to get started?
Okay, so we're going to kick off our credentialing 101 session, kind of covering the NCQA standards. So the first standard is regarding the credentialing policies, and so you have to have written within your policies information that outlines and covers these elements and factors. So the first factor is the type of practitioners you credential and re-credential, and it's important to include all of the various types, such as MDs, DOs, podiatrists, whatever is within your network, that is spelled out specifically in your written policy. Factor two, you have to list all of the verification sources that you use for verifying information. So you have to list all the, if there are different state licensing sites or boards and all of the other things, you have to list every single one that you use in your process. For factor three, you have to specify the criteria that you use in making your credentialing and re-credentialing. Factor four, you have to outline the process that you follow for making the decisions on the credentialing and re-credentialing files. And then factor five, you have to have a written process that outlines I can't read that part of the thing.
The criteria.
I think it's the credentialing files that meet your established criteria. Then for factor six, this is the non-discriminatory credentialing and re-credentialing, and you have to outline what you do to monitor and prevent discrimination in your decision making, and also have a statement that you do not do that. One of the ways you can monitor is to conduct an annual review of credentialing denials or complaints about denial decisions for credentialing. Factor seven, you have to notify the provider of information that varies from substantially from what they indicate on their application, from what you receive from the different sources that you check. Factor eight, you have to notify the providers of the initial credentialing decision within 60 days, and for any re-credentialing denials, that also has to be done within 60 days or less. Factor nine, you have to outline the medical director or physician responsible for the credentialing process. And factor 10, you have to specify about securing the confidentiality of all information in the credentialing process. And factor 11 is the practitioner directories and member materials are consistent with credentialing data. This is still within the same standard, but it's element B. This is about the practitioner rights. You have to specify that they have the right to review the information submitted to report the credentialing application. Factor two, you have to indicate that they have the right to correct any erroneous information, and Factor three, they have the right to receive the status of the application. This is the new element C under credentialing system controls. So if you were in the previous session, you would have heard Cynthia go through that, but I'm going through it again. Factor one, you have to outline how primary source verification information is received, dated, and stored. Factor two, how modified information is tracked and dated. So you have to indicate how it was modified and the dates, and then factor three, the staff authorized to modify or delete information when appropriate. Factor four are the security controls to protect unauthorized modifications. So again, this is the password protected ability to go in and modify any of the information received within credentialing. And factor five, you have to outline your auditing process for identifying and assessing risks. Standard CR2 is regarding the credentialing committee. So you have to have policies that outline participating practitioners that you have. Wow. This is
Factor one.
Yeah, this is the range of practitioners that participate in the committee. Factor two, that the committee has to review files that do not meet the thresholds. Factor three, review of the files that meet established thresholds. So that can be the clean file review and sign off by the medical director or designee. And now we are on CR3, the credentialing verification standard. And this is the credentialing file elements. Factor one, current and valid license to practice. Factor two, valid DEA or CDS in each state of practice. And for this, the provider either has to have their own DEA or CDS when applicable in the state they are practicing in, and if they do not have a DEA, or their DEA is pending, or their DEA is pending the new state that they've just moved to, you can have a covering physician write prescriptions for them and document that in this provider's credentialing file, and that's also acceptable. Factor three, you have to verify the highest level of education and training. Providers are not required to be board certified, but you must verify their residency completion if they're not board certified. Factor four, if board certified is applicable, so the provider has indicated that they are board certified, you need to verify that and have that documented in the file. Factor five, work history, you have to review the most recent 5 years, and if the provider has a gap in their work history, that is 6 months to 12 months, you can get a either verbal or written explanation. But if their gap is over 12 months, so a year or greater, that has to be in writing. Factor six, the malpractice history from either their malpractice carrier or the MPDB. And then now we are on element B. This is the review of sanctions. So factor one is the state sanctions and restrictions on licensure and limitations on scope of practice. You can use the licensing board, FSMB, other boards when they're applicable. Factor two is the verification of the Medicare, Medicaid sanctions, and you can use the Medicaid or Medicare intermediary, OIG, MPDB, FSMB, and I don't remember what other sources, but when.
Depends on what you'll want.
Sam, you're right. Thank you. My mind went blank for a minute. Okay, so element C, the credentialing application attestation question. So factor one is reason for inability to perform the essential functions of their position. Factor two, lack of present illegal drug use. The question doesn't have to specifically state drug. It can state impairment or some other language. Factor three, history of loss of license and felony convictions. Factor four, history of loss or limitation of privileges or disciplinary actions. Factor five, current malpractice coverage. And factor six, correct and completeness of application. If the provider either didn't sign their attestation or it's over the 180 days, all of the other factors will also be scored as non-compliant. And CR4, recredentialing cycle length. The length of the recredentialing cycle is has to be within the required 36-month time frame. And I will turn it over to Cynthia.
And I'm just going to add a note on the Medicare Medicaid sanctions. The SAM is a query that is required, but not specific to the NCQA requirement. It's not acceptable for the Medicare Medicaid sanctions for NCQA purposes.
Okay, I'm going to continue on here with the file documentation for CR5 through CR8. So the first screen here is showing the appropriate documentation. So this can be a combination of the following: documents that are signed or initialed and dated by the verifier, a signed or initialed and dated checklist for each PSV element, a single signature and date if it applies to all the verifications with that statement. So at the bottom, you'll see an example. Now this is a combination. So it doesn't all, your checklist doesn't have to have everything listed. You can have elements on your checklist, and then you can also include the file and with those actual documents. So it's the combination of all of us to make your file compliant. This is appropriate documentation, an example for an automated credentialing system. So an electronic signature or unique electronic identifier of the staff. So it can only be entered in by that verifier. And the system must identify the individual verifying it that the information and date of the verification. So at the next screen here, you'll see an example. There's some arrows being pointed. For example, the one on the left is the DEA certificate. That's the actual source that they used, is the DEA itself. Then you'll see the state that's listed, the verifier, and then the expiration date. The arrow to the right, you will see the NPDB. So it lists the source, the verifier. Here is a little chart that was put together to show you each of the elements that are required. It'll tell you if it's required for initial or recred, NCQA verification time limit, CMS time limit, which is the same as you use in ICE California, and then if date and initials are required. So you'll see license, it's required at initial and recred. The verification time limit is 180 days for both, and yes, it is required to be dated and initialed. I'm not gonna go through every single one of these elements, but I'll give you a second to look at it. As you see for education and training, it's only required at initial cred. It doesn't change otherwise. If they verify it, you're good. So there's no time limit prior to credentialing. Here's our sanctions. So sanctions are limitations on licensure. And then your Medicaid and Medicare sanctions. These are the credentialing application questions. So the inability, illegal drug use, history of loss of license, or felony conviction, the limitations of privileges, current malpractice insurance, and then your correct and completeness of the application. You'll see the difference. NCQA is 365, but for CMS in ICE California, it's 180 days. And I think I actually misspoke on the malpractice. The education and training. It's no time limit for NCQA, but for California, it was 180 days, correct? Yeah. Okay, so moving on to CR5, ongoing monitoring and interventions. So this is a policy and an evidence element. So for factor one, it's your collect and review Medicare, Medicaid sanctions. Those are some of the sources that can be used. And those are to be monitored every 30 days. Factor two is collect and review sanctions and limitations on licensure. There are some of your sources as well. That one is also needs to be monitored every 30 days. Factor three is collect, review, and investigate complaints. That factor is every 6 months that needs to be reviewed. Factor four is collect, review, and monitor for adverse events. Again, that one is also every 6 months. Now, those are evidence which we talked about in the previous presentation as well. Evidence needs to be provided on those four. So you want to make sure that you show that you are doing those reviews every 30 days and or every 6 months. Factor five is implementation on the results, basically, if you have poor quality. Factor six is notification to authorities and practitioner appeal rights. So factor one is the range of actions available to improve a practitioner's performance. So you want to list in your policies, how are you going to help this physician? What are you going to put in place for him if he's lacking on some of his requirements? And then report actions to the appropriate authorities. So your policies need to state that you are going to report to the NPDB and the state licensing agency. Factor two is making the appeals process known. So you want to let the practitioners know where that appeal process is so that they understand. That could be in, if you provide them a copy of your bylaws. Are these listed out on their website? You just want to state that this is listed here. And then CR7, which is assessment of organizational providers. Factor one is confirmation with the state and federal regulatory bodies. Factor two is confirmation of review and approved by accrediting body. So you want to list out what are the sources that you use for the accrediting bodies. And then factor three is site visit for unaccredited facilities. So if your facility is not accredited, then you need to make sure that you do a site visit for that facility. Now, if you have a main facility and then facilities following under that, if these facilities underneath of the main facility have followed the same policies and procedures and structure, a site visit can be done at that main facility and the following facilities can be covered under that. Element B, so this is factors one through four, is your medical providers. You want to list out in your policy the medical providers, your hospitals, home health agencies, skilled nursing, and freestanding nursing facilities. Factor one through three for element C is now going to be your behavioral health providers, inpatient, residential, ambulatory. Factor D is for assessing your medical provider. So now this is you actually reviewing those files, those facilities. And factor one for element E is going to be assessing the behavioral health providers. And in regards to the organizational providers, when you're assessing them, those providers don't need to be taken through credentials committee. A lot of provider organizations do take their organizational providers through CREG committee, which is more than fine. But just to understand is that you aren't, each element needs to be verified within the 36 months. It's not like the entire file needs to be put through in 36 months. So for their license and regulatory body, if they were, their previous date that they pulled the license was April 1 of 15, and the next time you did it was April of 2018, that's within the 36 months, so that's acceptable. And then CRA, delegation of credentialing. So factor one, this is in regards to the delegation agreement. This is not found in the policies. You want to make sure that this language is in the delegation agreement itself. So factor one is that it is mutually agreed upon. Factor two, and the mutually agreed upon is the signature date or the effective date on the agreement. And then factor two is describes delegated activities and responsibilities of the delegate. So you want to make sure each side, the delegate and the subdelegate, that their responsibilities are described in this agreement. Factor three is...
The semiannual.
Requires we, semiannual.
We can't see the whole screen.
Yeah, just to explain, there's a bar down here, so that last one. Okay, then factor four is performance monitoring. Factor five is right to approve, suspend, and terminate. Factor six is consequences for failure to perform. So you want to list, this all needs to be listed in that agreement to show when and if these things happen, what is going to go forth from there. Pre-delegation evaluations. So when you're conducting a pre-delegation evaluation, you need to make sure it meets all of the standards. So you're just not going to go to a subdelegate and say, hey, I want you to subdelegate. You need to review their policies and procedures. You want to make sure that they're doing what you need them to do and to do it properly. So some of the ways that you can do that is through a site visit. It could be a telephone consultation, review of their documents, committee minutes, a virtual review. This doesn't have to be as detailed and extensive of like how we would audit provider organizations. You don't have to have a full-blown audit report that we would provide. But it needs to be documented that you have reviewed their policies, you agree with their processes, and that you're going to subdelegate. Review of the credentialing activities. So for factor one, you need to annually review its delegates' policies and procedures. So if you're subdelegating every year, you need to make sure that you're reviewing their policies. Kind of how a health plan delegates out to a provider organization and conducts that annual review. And that needs to be conducted within 12 to 14 months. Factor two is an annual file audit. Factor three is just the annual evaluation. And factor four is evaluation of their reports. CR8 is opportunities for improvement. So you can identify and follow up on opportunities for improvement if applicable. So as a health plan, if you're auditing a provider organization and you find non-compliant elements, then you're going to want to make sure that they correct those. Or if you have to put them on an improvement action plan, you want to make sure you follow up and they have implemented what was found non-compliant. And then on this slide here, this just gives you the link to the ICE website, and the training tools are all listed on there. There's a lot of information that you guys can find very helpful. And it's listed in the library section when you go to the website. Does anybody have any questions?
Hi, Janine Angel from HealthNet of California. I'm not familiar enough with our credentialing kind of very high level process. Mm-hmm. What has been, I will say, the biggest challenge or lessons learned in anything that your committee has done over this last year that maybe was new or different that you could share with the group today?
When you say that our committee, do you mean that ICE, that the Credentialing Collaborative has done?
Yeah, if there's anything specific that, you know, health plans that maybe don't participate or groups that don't participate, like that they would get out of the participation. I don't know if on the HealthNet side how involved they are. But I'm I learned a lot today, and I wanted to see if there was anything specific that they would gain from participation if they're not currently active.
So that just gives me a great opportunity for my spiel. because if you've been here from the beginning, Mike started with the beginning of the day with the fact that ICE is a volunteer organization. Anthony and his group, who are doing all of our sound and video and everything, we pay them, and we have one administrator, Patty Hermans, who we pay. The rest of us are here, as my boss would say, working off the corner of our desk. But we do it because of the support it provides to other payers and to our provider organizations. It reduces the duplication of our efforts. I won't say it necessarily reduces the number of FTEs needed to do the work, because there's still so much to be done. But without the participation from both the health plans and the provider organizations, we simply cannot exist. Suki mentioned earlier, she's my co-lead for California for our policy meeting. She's also the co-lead for ICE Northwest in Washington and Oregon. Part of that is simply because others haven't stepped up to the plate to do that. So participating, though, you learn so much. So many questions come up, and as ICE co-leads, you can go in through the ICE website and submit FAQs. And so they come to us to respond. And many of the questions that come in through the website, we bring then to sessions like this today, and we address some of the reminders and things. Aren't new things for most of you, but we're bringing reminders because clearly there are those who don't know those questions. So participating can make a huge difference. Additionally, if you're not participating, then I'm probably not going to hear when you ask for our help on something, because I won't know who you are. You know, seriously, if you're involved in the meetings and you're participating in them, then when you say, is it possible to do this? Is it possible to add this to the audit tool or to change the way we look at things? If you're not there, we're not there to help each other then. And so by participating, it makes a huge difference. The way that ICE in the credentialing works, we use the NCQA standards, the CMS, DMHC, DHCS, and so forth. But in addition to that, if all the plans say, our department or our company requires this, can we add that? You're not being considered if you're not there for the vote. So being there is important. And as I've also said, the questions that come up keep changing because your employees are changing, our employees are changing, and they simply don't know historically, you know, what's been there. So it's just so vital to be involved and to be exposed, to get that exposure for your staff, for your employees. I think it's just huge. So there's my spiel.
Hi, Lisa Tilden from Blue Shield. You just indicated that you get questions sent to you, yes, that you answer. We're a fairly new credentialing team. Is there a way that when you get a question posed to ICE in general that you respond to the whole distribution list? Because we may have those questions but not even know it.
Right.
So, you know, so we go, oh, that's what we're supposed to be doing.
That's what we want to know.
That would be helpful, extremely helpful.
Yeah, so on the ICE website, if you submit your question through the website, we go in there and we post the answer. Unless it's something just very specific to you, then we may respond to you directly. But otherwise, we post the answer. You can go out and search the FAQ website for questions.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Many questions come directly to us via email because people get to know us. And so we may respond. But if you ask me a question and 3 days later he asks me a question, I'm going to bring it to the next meeting to discuss it. And that is how much of our discussions get going. Back left.
Please tell us your name and organization.
Hi, my name is Melissa Lopez. I'm with Kern Health Systems.
I have two questions. I think I know the answer to the first, but just wanted to kind of get clarification. So if a DEA is limited to government duties, like UCLA, can the provider use that DEA outside of UCLA at a different facility?
I don't believe that you, when it's a facility DEA, then no, they don't have the authority to use it outside of that organization, I don't believe.
Perfect. The second question is more so if you guys have any experience with looking at different specialties that may be not ABMS recognized. Our facility takes a stance that the practitioner's specialty has to be ABMS. Okay. We've had some recent providers wanting to be listed as weight management, and that's just not recognized, so we list them as internal med. But I just didn't know if you guys had any experience with that.
Yeah, so that does come up quite a bit. NCQA recognizes the ABMS specialties, as most of you are aware. There's a number of reasons for that. One simple one is that when ABMS gives a certification to a practitioner, they have already done the research and the verification of education and training. NCQA does allow you to accept other certifying bodies if your policies describe that. And if you then go to that certifying body and obtain verification from them that they have verified education and training. However, many health plans will not accept those other bodies. I can tell you that I sit on a credentialing policy work group who looks at those and is asked often, what about some of these other boards? So many have left the ABMS because of the MOC requirements. And in having researched for some of these other boards, many of them will certify you if you were previously ABMS certified. Then you go to them, and instead of jumping through the hoops of ABMS, you go to them, you pay the right fees, and so forth. But most of them are not holding you to the same standard and level of care that ABMS is. But if you're considering accepting other boards, I strongly encourage you to reach out to the health plans that you contract with, because they may not be willing to list, say, weight management. Other questions?
Any other questions?
Over here on my right.
Cheryl Copeland, Sante Community Physicians, Fresno. Mei-Ling, you mentioned about the questions you get via email or so forth. On the monthly conference calls, do you bring those, do you put those on the agenda? Are those discussed so that information you may have answered some of those of us that are sitting on that phone call, the conference call, will get that information as well? Or is it just put on the website to answer the questions?
As I was saying, if I just get one question about something and it's, you know, maybe just clarification, we don't necessarily bring that to the meeting, but we often see they're trending, and because the ICE co-leads across the markets work together and we meet together, if I know that one of them is having issues and questions coming up, then we do bring them back. And some of those we talked about today, it's like, can I have a virtual meeting, or can I just send an email to all my medical directors? That's very commonly being asked right now, is my credentialing committee all has access to Salesforce or Cactus or whatever your program is. Why can't I send one email to all of my MDs on my committee? They can go online, they can review the provider's files, they can sign off on there electronically. No, I'm sorry, they can't. Not according to NCQA. If you have a provider, an MD or designated physician who has the authority to sign off on clean files and those files meet that criteria, then you can do it that way. But otherwise, you must meet through some means, a WebEx, a conference call, or something to discuss the providers. So yes, we do, but I'm hearing that as a repeat question, so we will make a point of it going forward this year to bring those questions to the meetings.
Renee Barker, AIDS Healthcare Foundation in West Hollywood. Behavior health, I believe if a behavioral health organization is NCQA accredited, do we get file credit for that? Are you going to speak about that?
I didn't have that specifically down. Do you get if you're being delegated to for just the behavioral health?
Yes. One of our delegated groups is a behavioral health organization, mm-hmm. but they are NCQA accredited. So when I do their desk audit, I believe I read somewhere in NCQA guidelines that they get credit for a few things.
Yes.
Are you going to speak about that?
No, but I can address that.
Okay.
So in our delegation oversight in CR8, whether it's a behavioral health accreditation, if you're delegating to an organization who holds health plan NCQA accreditation or CRN network accreditation, then they do get auto credit for the NCQA elements for their file review.
Okay.
If they are an NCQA certified CVO, they get credit for the source they use for primary sourcing. But if they happen to also be delegated for decision making, they don't get auto credit on those files because they're not accredited in decision making. So there is some auto credit. Also for CR8, for your annual review, Cindy talked about the annual policy and procedure review of your delegates.
Mm-hmm.
Very important to know that you do not get auto credit for that annual policy and procedure review. If you delegate to a CR accredited or health plan accredited organization, you still must review their policies and procedures on an annual basis.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? I really appreciate your questions because it really gives us a pulse of where folks are at and what you want and what you need going forward in our presentations and our meetings. So thank you. Now, I know many of you were here in the first session. Are there those who were not, in which case, they've already pulled up the polling questions. So if you would like to open up your phone app and go to the polling questions, we can quickly go through those. So the first one is on the screen. While you're completing initial credentialing of a provider, the address on their DEA is in a different state. But the practitioner has said he will not write new prescriptions until he's received his DEA. Is that acceptable to put that file through with that documentation? We've got a couple of votes. Okay, so most of you may not be on your phones. Oh, there you are, you're getting logged in. So I'm going to go quickly through this. So the answer is no. However, you can still put that file through if you have the name in the file of someone who will write prescriptions on their behalf. So it is possible to process that file. Also, if they're transferring from another state, we used to often see that credentialing folks would put the out-of-state DEA with the application printout from where they'd gone on to the DEA registration online and submitted their new address. That alone is not acceptable. And because I had so many people challenge me on that one year, I just flat out called DEA to confirm it. And no, they cannot write prescriptions in this state until their DEA has the name of the state. So question number two. NCQA required a minimum of the most recent 5-year work history at initial credentialing. If the practitioners practice fewer than 5 years, does the time start at the initial licensure date, or the time does start? And that's correct. I'll just throw in there a bonus for you. If it happens to be a mid-level practitioner, especially a nurse practitioner, her work or his work history starts at the time they got their registered nursing license, because 99% of the time they were RNs before they finished their nurse practitioner, and that work history does count in your 5 years. The next question, It's appropriate for the credentialing specialist to query the AMA at the time of recredentialing to verify the physician's medical license, true or false. We're getting it back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is it is false. The AMA is not, it's a great thing to query for board cert, but it's not acceptable for the medical license verification. You do have to go to the board. So, next question. NCQA accepts a checklist if the checklist includes each of the following. And I'm going to, you can see those, the source, the date of verification, the signature or the initials of who verified the information, the expiration date or the report date, or all of the above. And that's correct. It is all of the above. If those things are not all on the checklist, though, you can use a combination of the checklist and the actual documents. Next question. The time frame between credentialing cycles cannot exceed 36 months from the previous credentialing committee. True or false? That is true. The time when it is acceptable is if that provider was on sabbatical, medical leave, in the military. In those situations, though, if it does go over the 36 months, you want to make sure that's documented in the file, and then that would be marked compliant. And next question. If the organization delegates any NCQA required credentialing activities, there needs to be a written delegation agreement. It must be mutually agreed upon. It must describe the delegated activities and responsibilities for each party. It must require at least semi-annual reporting. It should describe the process by which the organization evaluates the delegate's performance. It must specify the standard, the organization retains the right to approve, suspend, or terminate the providers. And it must describe the remedies that the organization may take if the delegate does not fulfill their responsibilities, and or all of the above, which it looks like everyone got correct. So it is all of the above. Next question. As an auditor, the delegate provides a checklist with the initials and the source, and the file documents are included. The reviewer has dated them but did not initial them. Is this a compliant file? Oops, they're changing their minds. It is a compliant file, as long as you have the combination of the two and you have all the necessary elements of dating, initialing, expiration dates, and so forth. The next question, please. NCQA accepts the practitioner's attestation signature through fax, digital, scanned, or photocopied. Signature stamps are not acceptable unless the physician is impaired. True or false? I think you guys all got the answer before I finished the question. It is true, and that is correct. The next question. As an auditor, a checklist is provided with all the required items dated and initialed by the reviewer. The checklist doesn't have the expiration dates. So have you guys noticed there's a theme here in some of these questions? It's because these are some of the things that come up on an ongoing basis that we want to remind you of. The actual documents aren't included in the file. How would the license element be scored? That's right, non-compliant because there's no expiration date. And I think the last question is the best one in this session. Next question.
I don't think they got that one.
Oh, they didn't get that one? Are you ready to go for a free drink? Do you have your little blue tickets? Are there any other questions before you go today? All right. Well, thank you all for participating, for staying awake through the final session. Mm-hmm. We appreciate your being here and your involvement. So thank you. If you do have any questions, feel free to come up and ask.
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you.